go.
Okay, let's go.
Let's go. So this is Finlay Porter. This is an interview for the Totnes Pulse, and I'm Tony G. And Finlay, so good to meet you. And
good to be here. Thank you for having me.
And how long have you lived in Totnes?
So I've always sort of grown up in and around Totnes. I've never actually lived in the town itself, but my earliest memories came from living in Ashburton, and then we moved a few years later to Gower Bridge, and then we moved again to sort of Lower Washbourne, and I'm now based out of Little Hempstead. So I've moved around a fair bit, but for the first sort of 18 years of my life, Totnes was always the central hub.
You're a writer now.
Mm-hmm.
And when did you first get the passion for writing?
Probably from quite an early age, to be honest. Mum's got a sort of collection of random bits and scraps where I used to scribble down little snippets of random stories and stuff. I've not really ever been much of a consistent writer. It seems to come in waves and ebbs and flows, and I've struggled to finish things. But I do remember from a very, very early age, I once did a small collection of, you know, tiny sort of one-page short stories, which I sent round to family members on printed paper. And that must have been from the age of, you know, 12 or something like that. That's how young it felt anyway.
So that's just over 10 years ago. Mm. So you went to sixth form college. Where was that?
That was Exeter College.
Oh, right.
Yeah, and that's sort of, at that time in my life, I wasn't really writing so much. I was reading a lot, and I was doing a lot of writing in a sort of critical essay writing style, but that completely changed my style of writing, really, because up until then it had been a little bit more expressive. And then at Exeter College, doing the International Baccalaureate, they have quite a different linguistic mode of expressing, or that they want, you know, the way that they want students to express themselves. So at that time, I was not doing so much creative writing, but I was doing a lot of academic writing.
There is sort of somebody who sort of really inspired you into the next phase of your life after you left college?
In terms of like writing, not so much. Definitely from the Steiner School, there are some really strong characters. Some of the teachers at Steiner are like, yeah, really incredible, actually, the amount of work that they have to take on, and the like the way that they're able to do the due diligence to each individual pupil is so remarkable. I actually just recently, the other day, reconnected with my class teacher, who taught us from between the ages of class 6 and class 8, so year 7 to year 9. Jonathan Hobbs, who I believe is still teaching at the school. He was always an excellent, excellent influence, very supportive, and he always, his one bit of advice was always to question everything, which has remained with me to this day. Other than him, my English teacher in Steiner School in the upper school of Steiner School was Tilly Meredith, who was actually the mother of a friend of mine in my year. And she was excellent. She really pushed me to never accept what I'd done as good enough, and always keep pushing for better, always keep striving for that one little extra step to see how you can develop an idea that tiny bit further to its fullest.
You went on to study writing at
Norwich.
Where? Norwich.
Norwich, yeah, UEA. I think the creative writing thing just became something that I was missing in sixth form. And I ended up going for UEA because it has such a reputation for the department. I found out later, after I arrived there, that the reason it has such a reputation is actually the master's course and not the undergrad. But there is a lot of crossover between postgraduate tour and undergrad, and some of the same lecturers are there. And the sort of culture within the uni and around the city, actually, it's recognised as like a UNESCO city of literature worldwide, which is, and there's some really, you know, they have the National Centre for Writing there at Dragon Hall, has some amazing events. So it really is, despite being quite a small, sleepy city, I'd say it's quite comparable to Exeter in terms of busyness. But despite being quite a small and sleepy city, it really has a lot going for it in terms of literature, in terms of the events that they have there and the authors that come to speak. and yeah, they're also the lecturers who actually teach on the course.
How have you found being a Totnesian or a near Totnesian?
Well, I think it's funny, really. The further you go away from Totnes, the more you are surprised when you meet people who have heard of Totnes. Because the further you go away, the more it feels like this sort of small little rural town. But then, I just never stop bumping into people who have heard of Totnes or know about it. It has some sort of reputation, you know, for better or for worse. Normally people speak very fondly of Totnes, you know, even if they've only visited a couple of times. I found it on the other side of the country, you know, Norwich is 6 or 7 hours away. People had often not got a clue what Devon was. They kept on mistaking it for Dorset. People have heard of Dorset more because it's maybe closer, but I did find a remarkable number of people who had heard or been to Totnes. As far as my identity as a Totnesian, I don't know. I think that's something which kind of ebbs and flows depending on where I am in my life.
After uni, which is fairly recent, you went off on a couple of adventures.
Mm-hmm.
You went to the Ukraine.
Yeah, that was actually sort of the first notable thing I did with myself after graduating. I didn't really have a clue what I wanted to do other than I wanted to go travelling again. This was not travelling. This was an opportunity which arose through a friend of mine who I met at university. So the organisation that I was working for is called Driving Ukraine, and they sprung up around the start of the war back in 2020 and at late 2021, 2022. Is when they started up, I think. And it started by a guy same age as me, who's also, incidentally, called Finn. Finn Watt. He is a really remarkable character. He's very focused and driven and motivated. He's the sort of man who just gets stuff done. Really good guy to be around, because you feel... I mean, he's certainly informal. Everything felt very informal and slightly chaotic at times, but... I was never sort of in doubt. So essentially what I did for these guys was just join them on one of their convoys. So far they've had dozens of convoys. They've sent over 145 vehicles to Ukraine to be used on the front line. Most of these vehicles will be old 4x4s, and generally they tend to come from British farms, because farmers are very supportive of the cause. And what happens, we drive them all the way over to Lviv. Lviv is... the biggest sort of westernmost city in Ukraine. It's about just over 2,000 kilometers away, so that's 3 days of driving. And once we get the vehicles to Lviv, we take them straight to the workshop there. We've got a fixer, Maxim, who is from the city, and he's partnered with a bunch of volunteer mechanics and stuff. They fix up anything that needs fixing, and they paint all of the SUVs in camo. Depending on where they're going to, it'll be a different sort of camo. And then they hand them off to essentially frontline medics, some of which will be military, some of which will be volunteers. There's also some British people who work as medical evacuation personnel out there. And essentially, yeah, these vehicles get turned into sort of war zone ambulances, which will extract people who need extracting, whether that's civilians or military personnel. And this is an ongoing thing across the whole eastern front of Ukraine. Apparently every 9 minutes an extraction is called for, whether that's civilian or military, like I said. So there's a constant need, and it's still ongoing. And although the war has not really been moving anywhere, it's quite stationary the past few years. Months and months. I mean, it has been going on for years. There's still that endless need. So I'm actually planning on going on another convoy in a couple of weeks.
Have you got a vehicle to take over yet?
I don't know. I've been looking to source one. Ideally, they tend to send over sort of groups of 4 or 5 vehicles at a time.
Yeah.
And ideally, I have been trying to sort of fundraise a little bit. I can sort of, yeah, share. I'll share the link around again after this. But I am looking for basically any sort of secondhand 4x4 that, yeah, that maybe needs a little bit of work, but if people were willing to donate it to the cause, could be then converted into an ambulance to be used on the front line.
Okay, if anybody wants to donate a 4x4 to be an ambulance in Ukraine and save people's lives, then we'll put a link up to Finley at the end of this recording. What's your route to Ukraine? Say you leave from Totnes, where would you go?
God, I can't remember the entire route. It varies a little bit, because last time I went was a year ago in October, and there was a bunch of roadworks going along across like the entire northern section of Germany. So eventually, basically what we did, we could go on the train, and an issue last time that we had was we had a Ford Ranger with a faulty starting motor.
Yeah, right.
So it would start and run fine, nothing wrong with it except for the starting motor. But we had to bump start it every time, we had to push start it. So sometimes we had a tow rope with us and sometimes we'd shove it from behind. But the aim was essentially to just not turn the engine off all day. So we would fill it up with the engine on and everything. And we got on the train and they were obviously like, you got to turn your engine off. So then we had to do a bump start in the carriage of the train as we went underneath, and they were giving us some funny looks, but anyway, we got it off the train. So yeah, take the train to Calais, and then we go through, I think it's Netherlands and then Belgium, or is it the other way around, and then Germany, and Germany's like a full day. We spent the night near Essen on the first night. It varies depending on how fast you manage to get through. We tend to book accommodation, find a place to stay on the road. But yeah, we stayed near Essen on the first day, then we did all the way across Germany and into Poland the next day. And then from Poland, it's all the way across, it's quite a long way through Poland actually.
Yeah.
it's yeah. the whole way across Poland, and then that's the border crossing. There's two or three that you can use, and they just find out on the day which one's going to be like the smoothest crossing into Ukraine. Because it's obviously quite a, you have to export the vehicles, so they need their V5C and everything, and there's a bit of paperwork to be done on the border. So it's a bit of a lengthy process crossing the border.
Well, it sounds like a great project and something. So you started doing that when you were 20?
22 was when I was 22, yeah.
Yeah, when you were 22. So, but since then you've been doing something else as well that you told me a bit about. But
yeah, well, that's sort of, yeah. Since then I've been slightly further afield. At that time that I was working in the cafe in Norwich, shortly afterwards I was just saving up a bit of cash to do some work abroad in Kenya. I did a gap year between sixth form and university, and the gap year was very much your classic sort of, let's go explore the world, you know, and how, you know, that's the sort of the way that most people travel, is just go out and see what's what and have a bit of fun. Well, this time was a bit different. I did a couple months on the edge of Lake Victoria in northern Kenya, mm-hmm. with an organisation called Imara Community Growth Network. That was incredible. I was doing all sorts of, actually kind of project management with them, and doing also some online communications, interviewing lots of people, writing blogs for them. I built a website for them.
And who are they?
They are a group of, it's essentially one family who founded it, Nixon, who was my host while I was staying there. I wasn't paid for this work, but I got food and accommodation. That was sort of the exchange.
Yeah.
So I stayed with him. Nixon's an incredible guy. He's got three daughters, and he's very, very passionate about community, and he has all these different ideas which he's not necessarily so good at achieving. You know, he has very big ideas and needs to learn to maybe take some smaller steps towards achieving them. But that's kind of what I was there for, was to try and do some sort of monitoring and evaluation of the projects that were going on there, and trying to see, okay, what can we realistically achieve in this local community given the budget that we have, which was very little, non-existent. Yeah. And so I ended up partnering with a couple of schools, and we also reached out to the local university and also like a polytechnic sort of college, which did practical training skills, and we were able to support them with some teaching resources and some upgrades to their school facilities as well.
Well, I've read your blogs that you've sent from there, which we should also put a link to, because Finley writes really good blogs. From the ones I read were all from Kenya, I don't know. But you were working with kids in a school or something, or in a commute, in a... What was that?
That was another place. So that was then, after a couple months there, I went to Nairobi and started working with a different organisation called Soweto Youth Initiative.
Yeah.
Now, they've got a German partner organisation called Underleers Trust. If you look for Underleers Trust online, they've got a really well set up social media and website. It's a really good gig. It's really funny seeing them work together, because Kenyans are notoriously, like, well, I don't want to say disorganized, but like there's an element of you know, relaxed sort of chaos to the way that Soweto operate their system. And then Leia, who I had the joy of meeting it while I was over there, because she came over to help with some events. She's like the stereotypical German organization. Everything is efficient, everything is written down, everything is labeled, everything's accounted for. So that was really nice to be on that, to be able to sort of gain that experience of working with two organizations that are working hand in hand, one from Europe who are sort of facilitating the fundraising aspect. Most of their funding comes from Germany, from German funders, who will essentially provide sponsorship for children to go to school, because the place where these kids are living, Soweto, is a slum area.
Yeah.
It's got a population of around 50,000 on the edge of Nairobi, and it is, yeah, it is some of the most like challenging living conditions that I've ever seen. It was truly shocking in so many ways being there and seeing, some of the things that people have to put up with. And also just the resilience and the perseverance that these communities have in face of, the sort of persistent challenges that they are forced to deal with, given that they have completely no support from the government and are kind of just forgotten by any authority. They're just left there on their own to try and dig themselves out of this mess.
It was very touching reading your accounts of life there. So you came back here, and now you are, where are you working now?
Now I work at the Green Table.
Oh, right, the Green Table, that's different from Kenya.
You're very, honestly, when I came back, I actually, the day after I got back, I went out and handed around my CV into places, and then a few days later I'd been given the job. So it was still like a crazy culture shock coming from being away for almost 6 months to then Green Table, which is a fairly new outfit. As of July, it was under new ownership, so everything in there is all clean and spick and span, and everything works, and you know, they have dishwashers and things which I had not seen for months on end, and I was like, oh, everything is a luxury.
Yeah, everything is a luxury. So if you had to describe Totnes to the rest of the world, can you encapsulate your, through your own eyes, what Totnes is and means to you? Or
it's a very worldly place, I think. I think that's one of the nice things, is that I wouldn't say I'm particularly special as a Totnesian, having travelled so much, because I think a lot of people in Totnes have also travelled. And I think the key sort of taking from that would be perspective. I think a lot of people in Totnes, you know, you do run into all these concerns and worries of like cultural appropriation and stuff. I think that is something that definitely the average Tunisian should try and remain critical of, but because there's a lot
I think that kind of that's a phrase that might escape a few people. What do you mean by cultural appropriation?
Cultural appropriation, I think, an example would be you see fair few people in Tunis up the high street with dreadlocks and that sort of thing, cornrows or whatever, and I think perhaps if people were aware or more, if people had taken the time to maybe like explore a little bit more through literature, the history of slavery and how that has impacted, how systems of slavery are what led to these sorts of hairstyles or whatever it is, perhaps they wouldn't necessarily wear those hairstyles.
Yeah.
This is a complete summary. I'm not the most informed person on this, and it is an ongoing debate.
I got you.
Over
what you mean is that if you just take something like a First Nations Native Americans headdress,
mm-hmm, yeah,
and put it on,
yeah,
so, and go around the festival wearing a headdress,
yeah,
without understanding that those things have significance and meaning within, mm-hmm, those communities,
yeah,
then it's like taking something from,
yeah,
them.
It's undermining the history of that, and also kind of suppressing the fact that those First Nations communities were so violently oppressed and in many cases massacred throughout the settling of Northern America white Westerners.
Well, we've moved. It seems impossible to kind of stay in Totnes on this conversation, but I think it's a very valid point that kind of Totnes is, although it doesn't appear to be, maybe on the face of it, it is quite an international community.
That's sort of where I was starting to get at with this. I think what I was trying to get at was the fact that a lot of Totnes has had the chance to explore, and that is an incredible privilege, explore the world. And from that has gained, I think a lot of people have generally gained some pretty, you know, useful perspective. And I think that's what makes it really interesting, is you have this diversity of cultural experience here. And also it sort of gives people the confidence to express themselves and be themselves, knowing that other people aren't going to be all judgmental and think, well, why are you acting or behaving or dressing in a certain way which is different? So I'd say generally, you know, Totnes feels very inclusive, feels quite welcoming.
In your wildest imaginings, if there was something that you could take from that international experience that is embedded in Totnes, in the inhabitants of Totnes, is there something we could make of it that would be kind of useful to the town or the rest of the world?
I think the biggest thing for me was feeling this sense of gratitude, because, you know, once you see how other parts of the world are living and operating, you recognize finally how privileged your life is, really, and how comfortable and beautiful Totnes is. And I think, you know, I've been spending a lot of time in places which are famed for their natural beauty. Kenya, of course, everyone's goes on safari for the Big Five and everything. But yet, at the same time, while I was living in a rural space on the edge of Lake Victoria, the lake itself is full of plastic pollution. They have a massive dump there. They burn their rubbish in the garden, and it's full of fumes. And none of the vehicles have MOTs, so they all pump out fumes because they just bribe the police instead. So the air pollution there is like pretty bad, and the water is like, I wouldn't swim in the lake ever because it's so disgusting. They have no sewage there. So essentially what I'm saying is that I know we obviously have a lot of problems in the UK with cleaning up the water sources and pollution and protecting wild spaces, but I think we have to be so grateful for what we have in Totnes. Having this access to the moor and access to the sea is so valuable. And speaking of access to the moor, I will also just remind people of the ongoing fight to with the right to roam. I think they're trying to start that court case again. So if you're in Totnes and you enjoy spending time on Dartmoor, please go and check out Right to Roam as well, because they're doing really important work to make sure that we can still access that wild space, which is so important.
All right. Well, yes, indeed. we need to keep this land is our land.
It is, yeah.
And thank you very much, Finlay. I think I think we'll just say thank you. And is there anything else you'd like to say, or anything
I feel like I've rambled enough. I feel like I've taken enough time.
Well, I think it was George Louis Borges who said, that's how a good conversation starts, rambling.
With rambling. And we've certainly achieved that today.
So thank you.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
That was Tony G talking with Finlay Porter. Totnes Talks is a Totnes Pulse production. Thank you for listening.